Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Talent Game podcast. Today, I'm joined by John Wright. Hey, John, welcome.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And we were saying before I hit the record button, known of you and your reputation for quite a while. So it's actually nice to get on a call with you and chat about all the stuff that we have in common.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, surprising stuff, you know?
Yeah. Like Dragon Ball Z and kids and et cetera. So, exactly. but for everyone else that doesn't know who you are, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, so I'm John Wright. I'm the Vice President of Mobile Games at Qualy. So we're a UK developer and publisher of mobile and PC games. I head up all of mobile, which consists of about 180 people. We have six internal studios, M&A studios, publishing. I have a very cool job. I basically get to work on games, and I've been in gaming now for about 12 or 13 years and loved it, and I will never leave.
Yeah, that's great, and we're going to talk about it in a moment, like how you got into that into the games industry and career switch. But first, you were just talking about games, being a game publisher. Like, what are you currently playing right now?
Yeah, so I have not really played anything on desktop or sort of PC console for a while because kids. But I still find myself as VP Mobile. I still find myself playing a lot of mobile games. Right, so. The games I've been playing recently, and there's quite a big world of difference between the three of them. But the first one is Solo Leveling Arise. So this is a action RPG based on the Korean manhwa, which is like a Korean manga. So it's very Asian influenced, very gacha based. Very, I have an array of different characters, different weapons, different abilities, different spells. And the idea is that I go through the content of the manga, and I love it. It's great.
That's cool. So, I haven't actually checked this one out. This is great. I like the art style.
Yeah, it's very unique.
Shaded art style.
The battle systems and the artwork and the sort of like just the overall vibe of the game. It's a hardcore game, right? This is a cross-platform game. I can play this on PC as well as on mobile, but I predominantly play it on mobile because. Just accessibility and time and stuff like that. But like I said, it's a fantastic story. And I'm a big, like, my gaming sort of genre of choice is RPG. The first game I ever really got hooked to was Final Fantasy VI on the SNES. And ever since, I've been, like, completely hooked. I actually have a whole sleeve of tattoo sleeve of Final Fantasy because I'm such a geek.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's about, you know, wearing your heart on your sleeve or wearing your passion on the sleeve. So I was like, I've also got Dragon Ball Z tattoo because I love Dragon Ball. So, I'm big in expressing yourself and expressing what you love, right? And that's why I've got it on my body.
What is, what's your favorite Final Fantasy?
Probably Final Fantasy VI, actually. I think it's, like, if you look at it, I think it's still got like a 96 on Metacritic. It's one of the...
Right.
If I remember right, it's top 25 highest scored games of all time. SNES, so it was before like the first generation. Like Final Fantasy VII gets the most traction because it was iconic for the moment, right? It was like 94, 95. It was the first time you saw 3D. And going from like 2D animation on an ATB style RPG going to like 3D. And I know it was very blocky and stuff, but at the time it was like a revolution, right? It was like same as Metal Gear Solid on PS1. I remember going from SNES to PS1 thinking, oh my God, what is this crazy 3D? You know, what is it? And honestly, man, I've got such like good memories of that because of it. But yeah, Final Fantasy VI, I think, is just, it's a perfect game because the story, the character development, the magic tech system. The bad guy, Kefka, is actually one of the only bad guys in any game that actually wins. So he destroys the world. And then you come back to defeat him after. Spoiler alert. You know, but the game's been out for 30 odd years. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, too soon? Too soon?
But it's just like, it really is gripping. And God, if they did a remake, it would be fantastic. You know, but they doubled down on Final Fantasy VII Remake, which makes sense because it was a bigger commercial success.
Yeah, and I love how they're dragging it out into like a trilogy.
Exactly.
One game remake. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a good move.
Square Enix, man, they can smell money. They can smell taps like me, you know, like spending £400 on three different games with the ultimate editions and stuff, you know?
Yeah, all of the 90s kids now who have disposable income and ready to buy these new video games. So you mentioned that Solo Leveling Arise. Was there anything else you're dabbling with on mobile?
Two other games. So Pokemon Trading Card Game Pocket. I've been playing that very, very aggressively. I recently, and it's one of my biggest achievements in life, is I've unlocked Mew, which is like you have to do like skip basically all of the good card, like all of the cards to be able to unlock Mew, and I did that. It was a very gratifying moment. I did a LinkedIn post about it. I'm so proud.
Oh, well, I need to go find this post and like it.
Yeah, please do. It's a great post. It's just a screenshot of Mew. But so, yeah, I was born in the 80s, grew up in the 90s. Pokemon is the biggest IP in the world, fact. And I was hugely into Pokemon cards. I have a shiny Charizard, believe it or not, I do. And it's just an iconic thing for me. I watch Pokemon with my kids. My kids love Pokemon, you know?
Yeah, I love watching it. But they actually really still like the 90s show, which I grew up with. And I'm also looking at my binder that I got when I was in primary school, filling that up.
I've got the same.
With all my cards. Yeah.
I've still got it, you know?
Yeah.
Last game I'm playing right now is one of Quali's games called Derailed. It just went into soft launch 2 weeks ago. Cool. It's an idle RPG, so it has a lot of those mechanics and elements that I love from RPGs. It has like monster battling, it has equip systems, it has, you know, basically resource gathering, and it's sort of a post-apocalyptic journey to salvation. And you've got a train. And your idea is to get the train to safe haven, and you have to go through different worlds and different missions and battles to be able to get to this safe location where there is people. So I guess it would be something like The Walking Dead meets Snowpiercer meets Final Fantasy. It's a much more casual RPG. It's not a hardcore game. It's easy to pick up. It's more hybrid casual than anything. But I think it's a great game, and we're only in soft launch. We've got another 6 months of content, you know, to put into it. We'll probably hard launch in the next couple of months, but we've got a very strong, you know, product pipeline for it. And I'm just really excited to see how that game matures.
Yeah. But well, hey, best of luck. Like, goodness, it's not an easy. I don't know if it's ever been easy launching mobile games, but it feels like now more than ever is particularly tougher just launching any game. Yeah, so wishing you the best of luck with all of that.
It's never been tougher to launch a game than right now in my career. Like, I spent over a decade in gaming, and you know, PC and like Steam especially is a bit more sort of, you know, straightforward right now. But mobile is, you know, depending on what way the wind blows, it could be a success or not. and it's very tough. And equally, it's kind of sometimes it's a bit demoralizing for the team, right? If you're working on loads of different concepts, prototypes, and, you know, you're not getting to that eventuality of hard launching and having the game in the hands of millions of players, you know, having to deal with the mental strain of like consistent failure is something that, you know, we have to kind of safeguard with our teams, right? It's to ensure that they continue to be positive and understand that it's a process and it takes time. A few years ago, it was much easier to launch. And so people got used to having a success a couple of times a year, you know, more than that. Some companies were launching a game a month, right? Now, if you launch one or two games a year, you're lucky. So it's a big sort of change in the industry in the last couple of years.
Yeah, this is going to be this safeguarding culture. And I'd definitely love to dive into that talent topic as well in a moment, so that sounds great. Going back to like what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, which was like getting into the games industry, I'd love to hear that story, because before we started recording, you mentioned that you'd been an accountant in a past life. So there's a story to be told there, so I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, look, I'm very happy to talk about this story. I think it shows that persistence is king. And if you really want something and you work hard enough and you're willing to make enough exceptions, you can do anything, right? It's just if you choose, you want to do that. So for me, I was, you know, from the age of 16, I wanted to be an accountant, right? I grew up in a very working class family on a council estate in East London. And, you know, my parents both did manual. My mum was a hospice nurse. My dad was a builder. And, you know, they wanted a better life for me and my brother. So they pushed us to go in to get, you know, better jobs. And I was good at maths. And they were like, okay, be an accountant. And that was literally my life. By 14, my life was decided, right? It was like, you're good at math, you're going to be an accountant. And I spent, you know, 2 years at college doing something called an AAT, an Association of Accounting Technicians qualification. And then I went to, you know, basically to university to do another qualification called a CIMA, Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. And, you know, I spent 4-5 years basically doing that. And then I went into work and I did management accounts for a couple of years. And I hated my life. Absolutely hated it. I was literally in a basement with 40 other middle-class white dudes. I was the only person from... not from like middle class family. I was the only one who talked like I worked on the docks. And basically I just really didn't like life, my life, Joe. And then I made it my, you know, I've been with my wife since I was 20. So we've been together. It was actually our 14th wedding anniversary on the weekend. So,
oh, well, congrats.
Thanks, mate. She's the one. She's the best thing about my life is my wife and my kids. You know. But, you know, she said to me, she was like, you just don't like this, right? You just don't like this corporate finance accountancy thing. You know, it's very clicky. It's very in, you know, you have to end up going out like 2-3 nights a week, drinking with people to be part of the inner circles. You know, the corporate politics and bureaucracy is crazy. You know, again, there's not a good understanding of, I mean, things might probably change now. This was 15, 20 years ago, right? So it was a different time. But equally, I just didn't like it. And my wife was like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life? Because I was 26. By 26, I was already married. I thought my life was set out, you know? I was like, in a good job, earning good money, you know, compared to my friendship group and family, I was doing really well. But I was just unhappy. Like every day I had that, you know, that Sunday dread, right? When you think, oh my God, I've got to go to work tomorrow and I don't want to do it. And I felt that bottom of my stomach. You know, and I know a lot of people in the job market, they feel like that and they feel pressured or forced into a certain career. But I made a conscious decision to make a change for my mental health, for my own benefit, for my, you know, I thought to myself, I'm going to be working for another 40 years. So why not change now? Right? Like, you know, still, even after contributing like, I know, 10 years towards this accountancy dream, I thought I'm still only 20% through my working life. So I can change. I can do this. And so what I did basically was I got an opportunity to start working in marketing, performance marketing on e-coms. So, you know, e-commerce, it was in the fashion industry. It was my step away from finance to do something else with transferable skills. And that sidestep for me cost me, you know, probably a 40% drop in my salary, right? However, me and my wife made the conscious decision that we were safe, you know, we could, you know, continue to do what we needed to do without you know, that sacrifice of a huge amount of money. And over a couple of years, I slowly but surely made a conscious effort and plan to apply for gaming jobs within this sort of transferable skills realm. So I looked and said, okay, I'm good at numbers, I'm good at finance, I'm good at understanding profit and loss and all of this stuff. What's similar in another field, and it was performance marketing. It's all calculations, it's all numbers, it's all understanding profitability. So I was like, okay, I can do this. And then after a couple of years in this adjacent field, which was e-coms, I got an opportunity to join a company called Green Man Gaming, and the rest is history, basically.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, big fan of Green Man Gaming as well. So that was a great first place to start in the world of publishing too. So exactly. There's a lot of things that you said in that story that resonated with me. first of all, I've often said that my wife has been such a great person to like guide me throughout my career and everything else. Yeah. So we've also been together since we were like 19. So there's that.
Yeah.
So she knows me better than I know myself sometimes, and she'll call me out and be like, "You're not happy," when I'm like, "Oh, am I not?" Yeah. "Oh yeah, I'm not happy." Or like, yeah, you should follow your passion and go do that thing. So I'm glad you have someone in your corner in life helping you with that.
Absolutely. If it wasn't my wife, it would have been, I'm a big believer in mentors. I mentor a lot of people. You know, again, I manage 180 people in Qualy. If it wasn't, my wife has always been a confidant and someone I trust. But equally, if it wasn't my wife, it would have been, you know, one of my mentors would have said to me at some point, "You need to do this." You know?
Yeah.
The toughest thing, Joe, was, and one of my big beliefs about this industry within gaming is the fact that generally people want to bring each other up. You know, I like to say that, you know, a high tide rises all ships, and I'm a big believer in sharing information and helping people if I can. And the reason I do that was because I didn't actually have that when I transitioned. That's why it took me 2 years of hard graft to get to that point. I think to myself, if I would have had someone on the other side of the door who could have opened it a smidge, then I could have moved over even quicker, right? Yeah. So, it's gaming ecosystem and industry is so much friendlier and nicer, and people care about each other. And like, all you have to see is like people like, was it Amit Satvat, who like, you know, does all of this stuff, you know, like, you know, there's people out there are generally trying to help people break into gaming, find new jobs. And it's because gaming is a passion for people, you know, it's something that resonates them on a deeper level. It's part of their identity, who they are, what they like. And it's a much nicer place to be, really.
I often say a very similar phrase to that. Yeah. When one of us rise, we all rise. And I think we're all just humans trying to live a happy life. So it's like, if you know, like for us two, like gaming's been part of our lives since we were small children, right? And it's like what we love to do in our spare time. So bringing it into your work and what you do as a profession, it's like, great. I love this. I love contributing to something I love to do just for fun anyway. Yep. So what a great call, making that those proactive steps. Yep. And I mean, you've had just to round out that story, like you kind of stopped like as you got into games, but you then have had an incredible career in games over the last, like I said, 12, 13 years or so.
Yeah.
So I guess briefly, what has that progression been like? I'd love to, like anyone listening, like you've obviously now in a VP role
at a really
well-respected mobile PC console games publisher. Like, how did that happen? How did you get there?
Yeah, man, look, gaming's been very good to me. You know, I really just, you know, thank my lucky stars that I got into this. And I think a lot of it comes down to passion, right? And I've been a gamer for over 30 years, right? My first console was an Atari, which was a hand-me-down. And then I got my first new console was a Sega Master System. And it was one of the ones where you turned on and Sonic was pre-installed. You didn't even need a cartridge, you know? And yeah, so it's just been something that I have been drawn to and something I've loved my entire life pretty much. And I do believe, again, that passion for gaming is one of the main contributors as to why I've been successful in gaming. Because, so my first role was performance marketing manager in Green Man Gaming. I did this for actually for less than a year, and I was headhunting to join a company called IronSource, which is, you know, on the gaming tech side. So they're, you know, big in the sort of user acquisition, monetization, mediation, gaming tech sort of ecosystem and environment. They have a, you know, best in market sort of products, you know, to help gaming companies monetize and again do user acquisition. And I joined as a senior account manager, and I was working with, you know, big companies like Ubisoft and King and Outfit 7. And I was really fortunate to be what I think to be good at my job. And, you know, my role was very simple. It was to work with gaming companies, you know, and guard their investments, so to speak. So it was like, they have budgets, They want to spend the budgets on our network. And it was my job to ensure that the quality of the traffic and what they got back was you know, good quality users who played the game that resulted in people then making money. And then they would invest more money and more money. And, you know, over time, I went from, you know, again, senior account manager to account director to director of strategic accounts. I know it's a bit of a weird one, but it's a higher title. Is that corporate for you? You know, they just mix words around. And I found myself going from managing, you know, medium-sized companies to managing billion-dollar companies. And then I was managing regions, right? And, you know, I used to head up essentially Europe. And I would, and because of my, I guess, because of that seniority, I then got exposure to dozens of different gaming companies, you know, different types of companies, different locations. I found myself on a plane every week or every 2 weeks going to, you know, Finland and Denmark and Slovenia and, you know, France, Germany, US, Asia. And, you know, Iron Source was a really, really good sort of, you know, 4.5, 5 years of my life. I even went and lived in Tel Aviv for nearly a year, which was an amazing experience for me. I've never lived abroad or anything like that, but I found it was I got to learn a lot about myself, you know, living abroad. And then, yeah, look, I moved across and I joined a game developer / publisher called Coded Platform, and I was the head of growth there. So I was managing all of the user acquisition and monetization, as well as the first sort of commercially successful publishing portal. So where people could sign up, enter games, you know, and then there was an automation that ran the games. And then you didn't have to have a one-to-one or a personal connection. You could just go on and submit, and then we would contact you if the games were successful and then discuss all that stuff, which was a great learning curve for me. And then I probably made the smartest business decision I ever did, which was I joined a startup called Luna Labs. I was late stage, you know, founder / part of the founding team as vice president of operations. And that was an amazing opportunity for me because I joined a very, very small company with amazingly talented, you know, founders. And we sort of did what many people think is the fairy tale. We grew the company and we sold the company to Iron Source, funny enough, which was my previous employer. So I left Iron Source to be part of the founding team of Luna. We had an amazing 18 months where we went from zero money to being highly profitable and working with, you know, 70, 80 of the biggest gaming clients in the world. The company basically did playable ads. It was a technology that helped studios build playable ads without needing to basically design them themselves. They could use the Unity code. It was like a revolutionary tech at the time. And that resulted in us selling the business, and it was a life-changing event for me. You know, I went from living check to check to having, you know, a substantial amount of money and doing a lot of things that growing up in a council state, I never thought I would do, you know, like buy my own house and do all this other stuff. So it was, you know, highlight of my career for sure. Iron Source was then eventually acquired by Unity. So Luna basically inadvertently became part of Unity, and I was head of client services for Unity for Europe for about 18 months. And then I left and I joined Qualy, which is where I am now.
Oh, great. And thanks for running through that with me. And yeah, it's like I said, fairy tale story. You always love to hear from successful founding exits. I mean, I'm in the world of VCs and startups now. And so, yeah, I absolutely love hearing these stories. So yeah, for sure. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, can happen. Don't get me wrong. Those early days of Luna, they were crazy hours, right? It was me and the founders were working 7 days a week, you know, sometimes 14 hours a day. But you know the craziest thing, Joe? It was great. It was fun. It was dynamic, man, you know? Like we just had energy because we literally loved what we did and we believed in the vision. We knew we were going to be successful. We knew we had something here and we went all the distance, you know? And this is the thing, when people are in jobs that they don't enjoy, My honest opinion is to get out of Dodge, you know? Yeah. Go do something where you want to work for 12 hours a day. And people will have to say, you've got good people around you who say, no, don't do that. You know, we care about you. You know, do your 8 hours. And you're fighting them, you know, to do more, and they want you to do less. But yeah, if you can find that, that's the fairy tale, man, you know?
Well, so this is a nice segue then about, I guess, on the theme of culture. So how do you find that? How would you, first of all, advise someone to figure out that what type of culture actually makes them thrive and that they'd love? And secondly, how do they find it? Like, how do they assess it? How do they know it when they see it? Like, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, culture is a big topic, right? It's kind of like the X factor. It's if you can have good culture within a team or in a company, it could be the difference between success and failure. For me, you know, culture was about it was about making sure that everyone knew that we were all in it together, that we were essentially, you know, I played semi-professional rugby, and my management style was something that I refer to as the captain's approach. And essentially, we are 15 players on a field. And even though I was the VP or, you know, of Luna or at Qualy, the fact is I'm still on the pitch. I'm still doing my role with the team. And the only difference as the captain is I dictate strategy. I say we're going to do this play, right? I say we're going to do this. But everyone on the pitch, including me, puts my body on the line for the person next to me. And if you have everyone on the same page who believes in that, fully believes in that, then that for me is culture. It's everyone being on the same page, understanding why we're doing something and believing in it to the point where they want to do everything they can to succeed. Mm. And it's very hard to build. But again, I believe strongly it's by letting everyone know that essentially it's like flat structure. It's like letting everyone know that I am no better than them just because of my title. We're all people. We all care about each other and we all work to one end goal and vision. There is no massive difference, even if, you know, you're a junior and I'm a VP.
Hmm. Yeah. You know what? In the first season of this podcast, the phrase psychological safety came up quite a bit. And also your analogy from being on the rugby pitch also reminded me of a talk with the Netflix CEO, I forget his name, but he was talking about the trust on the team and that culture of trust, like being like a blind pass, being like, if everyone's on the same page, following the strategy, passionate and wanting to win, that, hey, blind pass in rugby, right? You're absolutely gunning it down the wing and you don't even have to look. You just throw it off and someone's going to be there to catch and drive forward. And it's like the equivalent, I think, of a blind pass, like especially in a startup where you're moving fast or any sort of culture where you're moving fast. It's like everyone has their own roles and clearly designated roles. And I know when I hand this off to someone else, I don't even have to think about whether they're going to nail it or not. I just know they are. And that allows me to really hone in on what my strengths are because I know someone else is going
to. It comes down to, and I'm a big believer in managing by outcomes, Joe, you know, so I believe, you know, I trust all of my leadership team, all of my directors, all the specialists I have in Qualy, I trust them completely. And I say to them, guys, the outcome, what we want is this. And I don't sit there and watch them, you know, basically, you know, make the decisions of how we get there. It's essentially, we're at A, we need to get to B. If they decide to go this way or this way or this way, I trust in them completely to make the right decisions so that we come to the outcome that we've designated together. And managed by outcomes and building a culture of trust is the most important thing, I think, for a startup business and also for you know, up to a medium-sized business. Eventually, for a corporate, you can't have that level of trust because there's thousands of people and stuff like that. But ultimately, it's such an important factor, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you say that about large companies because, yeah, you can't, it's quite rightly, like you can't just trust someone you've never met or never built a relationship. There can be a level of trust that you're like, I know the hiring bar at this company is high. Yeah. Therefore, I'm going to assume that that team in another country and another org over there is really good as well. But yeah, like I said, you haven't built the trust hands-on like you with a small company. Any thoughts on that though at the large company level? Is it you're building trust at the team and then you're just building out that layer at the org and then et cetera from there?
Exactly. Look, like I said, I've been fortunate to work for more big corporate companies than I have startups, you know? Mm. And there is definitely, you know, there's different strategies and how to get people, you know, thousands of people all aligned. And you have to obviously have a really good, you know, top line strategy as a business. Like, what do we want to achieve for being this 1,000-person or 10,000-person company? And everyone needs to buy into that bigger vision. But ultimately, I think that's one part of it. And the other part is understanding your silo, your team, your division, what the desired outcomes and goal is for you guys. And it might actually not conflict, but it might not fully align with another team, right? So it's about ensuring for your team exactly what you want to achieve as part of the wider vision, and ensuring what you do contributes to that bigger vision what's set by the C-level.
Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, I often talk about this concept of microcultures or subcultures or something. Mm. So you can have the Qualy culture. There'll be common threads through every org. But it's like, all right, well, what about on the mobile side? What about these 180 people in this side? Do we have function slightly differently? Are we our own pack in some way, slightly different to, I don't know, the PC console folks?
Yeah, no, completely.
And you've got stuff in your control and out of your control. Obviously, the wider business stuff is out of your control, but your own team, you've got a lot of control over that, I guess, and that culture.
Yeah, completely. I think one of my sayings is get shit done, and it's basically a way to live life, right? I say to the guys, we're here to get shit done, you know, like just make something happen. And sometimes, you know, don't dwell on something, right? Don't overly discuss something. Make a decision, cause an action, and get something done. Rather than deliberating. And what you find in corporates is bureaucracy and politics. I'm like, forget that. Just get shit done. And the guys like that because it's simple. It's easy to understand, right? We're here to make something happen. And especially with games, like creation of games is essentially building something, right? It's creating a product. And that requires us to do things and complete actions. It's not just deliberating or talking about all this fluffy stuff. There is, you know, things that need to be done on a day-to-day basis to build this thing, right? And I always like to say to the guys, we're in the business of fun, right? It's a business. It's a serious business. We're looking for positive EBITDA. We're looking for strong, you know, profit and loss and profit in general. But ultimately, it's the business of fun. And we cannot forget that what we're trying to do here is create fun and enjoyable experiences for people, you know, to you know, just enjoy their life with and to have a little moment of just joy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the absolute holy grail of culture, though, isn't it? Where you've got these two circles. One of them is called productivity it's delivery, right? Yeah. Delivery on or commercial or whatever you want to call it. Ultimately, your business is generating revenue and your products are at high quality and everything else. It's like, cool. And then you've got the other side. It's like, do people actually enjoy working there? Are they their true selves there? Will they stay and will they be retained? So that side of culture. And it's like bringing those two together, like right in the sweet spot. It's like, is everyone loving working here? And is everyone delivering their best work for the business? It's like, I've worked in companies that I've been in one camp or the other, like super, like exceptional product quality, hated working there. Or like love working there, terrible product quality. I've been in both scenarios. And so, like, really trying to find that sweet spot, I think, is in a nutshell, perhaps.
Yeah. But look, again, I feel like that's, you know, leading by example as well, right? Mm. Like, you as a manager or as a director or as a leader or a C-level, you have to do what you say and mean what you say. And, you know, again, if you lead by example and show the team that we can do this and you can get your hands dirty and get involved when you need to and deliver something, then it sets the example for everyone else to follow. So I'm also a very big believer in that, you know, like I like to say to the guys, there is no task too small for me to contribute to. You know, if for example, if we've got a launch coming out next week and all of the guys are hands on tools and there's, I don't know, a user complaint, I'll deal with it, you know, like I'm happy to jump in because Yeah, I'm kind of leading the org and looking at all these other numbers, ensuring that companies do well. Yeah, sure. But ultimately, I am not creating this thing, right? I'm giving, my job is to ensure that my team can do what they do to the best of their ability without blockers or headaches. My job is dealing with that stuff, right? So if there's some, you know, BS thing that pops up and it's like one of my top people is saying, oh no, I'm going to have to stop coding the game because I need to deal with this. If I can deal with that for them, to allow them to do what they're good at, best believe I'm doing that, right? Because that will allow us to get to the outcome.
Yeah, I really love that. I love that captain leadership, or I guess servant leadership is often referred to as well. I love that. I love that. And knowing that you're in there with the weeds with the team, obviously, there are limits. Like, you are a person with a certain set of skills as well. Like, you are also best served in a particular role doing particular things. But I love the sentiment and the willingness and the, and also the show don't tell, right? Like, the launch is coming and then you've jumped in and done it. You don't just tell people, I will help with whatever you need. And then when push comes to shove, actually, I can't.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I won't. So,
mate, you know, I said it's leading by example. You've got to do what you say. You know, don't just say something for optics. You know, just if you're going to do something, say you're going to do it and then you basically do what you say. And that helps build trust, right? So, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of very intelligent people in the games industry, and you know, it's very easy to sniff out BS, isn't it? Like, you don't have to be a genius to work out, oh, this person says a lot of things and then doesn't actually do those things. Like, you know, we're all pretty smart. We can see those people a mile off.
It's a small industry as well, Joe, right? Like, word of mouth and just, you know, having a good reputation mean a lot, because there's not millions of people in gaming, there's a couple hundred thousand, and so it's like, was it 7 degrees of separation? It's like, inadvertently, me and you are probably connected to everyone in gaming through 7 degrees of separation, right?
And
in some cases, you know, like, I know someone who knows the CEO of Netflix, so I inadvertently, through one connection, I could get into one of the biggest companies in the world, right? And that's one of the things I love about gaming, is the fact that it is small in certain aspects, right? And it is, like I said, it's very easy to get found out. And I like that. I like the fact if you're a bad actor, that eventually people will know, right?
Yeah. No, I do as well, because it's like, if you back yourself and you're proud of your work, you're like, I want everyone to, you know, see me and I'm going to put myself out there.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm fine with that. Hey, we're roughly coming towards the end. So I'd love to know, is there any final words of wisdom or nuggets or anything else like that with regards to the talent topic that we haven't touched on that you've wanted to mention, or any like final thoughts on the stuff we've talked about so far at all?
Probably two things. You know, which I really stand by, and smarter people than me have said this, but hire smarter people than you, right? So I am not the smartest guy, you know, in the world. I have to know there are people out there who know certain things that are better than me, and ensuring that you hire smart people and listening into them is one of the best advice you can ever have. Too many people, C-level says, hire people and then tell them no or question strategy or anything else, which is completely just, you know, wrong in my opinion. And always, always, again, my opinion, prioritize work ethic and drive. A lot of time people ask me, you know, do you hire the smartest guy or the hard and most hardworking guy or girl? And for me personally, I have done much better in my career, you know, picking and hiring people based on that than maybe the most intellectual, right? I believe drive and work ethic are such important things, especially in the startup ecosystem where you have to wear many hats. Sometimes the person who's willing to work hardest is the most valuable. So yeah, hire smart people and listen to them, and don't discount work ethic and drive versus a degree, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. It, this plays into, like, you know, I do a lot of interview training for founders in our investment portfolio. And I often talk about hiring for potential as well. And they're like, well, how on earth do you measure for potential? It's like, all right, well, if you really know what your culture is and what your values are, and you know, you find someone who really aligns with that, and work ethic, I think, you know, as well plays into it. If you find someone who's really culturally aligned, like nailing it on every front, and everyone unanimously agrees, and then it's like, oh, but their skill set currently is like down here, right? And it's like, okay, well, we're going to hire you. This is going to be a strong potential hire because we believe that you will be in the correct environment here to learn, progress, and you know, that hockey stick graph go straight up. So
yeah, I think it's much easier to skill people up than teach them determination.
Yeah, 100%.
And again, it goes back to being on a rugby pitch. Sometimes you have, you know, the guy who can do, you know, champagne rugby and be like this amazing, you know, self-contributor. But in actual fact, I want the donkey. You know, I want the guy who's going to put his body on the line next to the man and do the hard work, not the showboaters, the people who are going to make the difference on the ground. And a lot of people listening to this probably won't understand the rugby references, but trust me, it's a mentality thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, rugby is a sport. I do love it. Also, the humility as well in playing rugby. And it's just like, yeah, you need that. You look right. So you look at any of the best rugby teams. I'm not going to go on a massive tangent here, but, you know, think about like the England rugby team and the values they try to show when on the pitch every single time. It's like, and you compare that to like the England football team.
Yeah,
perhaps football culture in general. It's like, okay, values on the pitch and show don't tell. That's great. Cool. I love that. I'm glad I asked if you had anything else. Sorry, was that?
That's it from me.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Feel free to wrap this up. Yeah.
You're like, all the wise words have gone. I've
got nothing left, mate. Nothing left. Like, you've got the best of it.
That's great. And by the way, I did have one. Well, I did have my closing question. My closing question that I might catch you off guard a little bit here with this, but my closing question for everyone has been, what is your favorite interview question? What's your favorite interview question? Or do you even have one? Like?
I can tell you the question that I enjoy asking the most. And it's actually this one of the questions you asked me today, which is every interview, and again, I've hired hundreds of people over the last couple of years. Every interview, I always ask people, you know, what is their favorite game and why? And I've found certain people, but in gaming, you have a lot of introverted people. Sometimes people interview badly. And if you get people talking about their passion for games, you see them light up. And a lot of the time, I've made judgment calls on hiring, not off the back of the professional questions, but seeing their reaction to talk about something they love, which is the game they choose. And I think it's very disarming in a way to talk about something like that versus, again, where do you want to be in 5 years? You know, all of this other stuff, which is completely just irrelevant in my opinion.
I love that. And it's also partly why I start these podcast episodes asking what you're playing right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's great. I have a very similar, a slight tweak on that question that I like to ask a lot, especially anyone, you know, it's not just anyone in games, especially like product people, so game designers, QA programmers, etc. And it's like, I'll ask that question. Tell me about your favorite game. Why is it your favorite game? And then an additional one would be like, there's one thing you could change about that game, what would it be? Mm. And that there, I'm looking for the leap going from an enjoyer of games to someone who critically thinks about games and is intellectually curious about games as well.
Good one. So, I like that.
Yeah.
I might use that next time. What would you change? No, because again, I always get people talk about games, but never ask them to have a critique. It's good feedback. Maybe I'll evolve my interview technique moving forward. Oh.
Sorry, I didn't want to be like, I like that question, but I have a better one for you. So, my bad. Sorry about that. John, it's been a real pleasure. It's been a very, very fun, let's say 45 minutes or so. I loved hearing about your whole career that you've been on and that real purposeful transition into games. And then wow, like that, just how your career has taken off since getting into games and all the things that you've achieved. And I really, really resonate with your thoughts about culture and managing people and captain on the pitch leadership. I think that was great. It was really, really enjoyable to hear it. And anyone listening, I hope they got a lot of value for it. So thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, mate. Thank you for inviting me again.